namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so today I was planning to do a sutta which is called the Bala Pandita Sutta. It's Majjhima Nikaya 129. Bala Pandita is Pali for fools and wise. In other words, fools and wise people. This is what the sutta is about. And essentially, it is just a distinction between what, according to Buddhism, is a foolish person and what, according to Buddhism, is a wise person. But on an ordinary worldly level, not on this kind of supramundane level in the sense of an arahat or sotapanna, just an ordinary wise person compared to an ordinary foolish person. That's what this one is about. So this is on page 1016 in the Pali translation of the Majjhima Nikaya. And the sutta goes as follows. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove and at the Pindika's park. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this. So this sutta is taking place in Savati, which is of course the place where the Buddha spends most of his time. And the Buddha said the following, "Monks, there are these three characteristics of a fool, signs of a fool, attributes of a fool. What three? Here a fool is one who thinks bad thoughts, speaks bad words, and does bad deeds. If a fool were not so, how would the wise know him thus? This person is a fool, an untrue man. It is because a fool is one who thinks bad thoughts, speaks bad words, and does bad deeds, the wise know him thus. This person is a fool, an untrue man." Okay, so this is basically, according to Buddhism, then what is the definition of a foolish person in Buddhism? And there's one word here which I should comment on a little bit, and that is this word, an untrue man, or untrue person, if you like. This obviously is equally valid for both genders here, a true person or untrue person. And this is basically just a terminology for somebody who's not an Arya, somebody who hasn't seen the Dhamma yet. The Pali word is sapurisa, and it literally means a good person or a good man. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates this word as superior person in his Samyutta Nikaya translation. And the reason, of course, why it is a superior person is because it's a designation for an Arya, and Aryas are the superior people in Buddhism, the Sotapanna, the Arahants, once-returner, non-returner Arahants. So this is what is meant by an untrue person here. Okay, a fool feels pain and grief here and now in three ways. If a fool is seated in an assembly or along a street, or in a square, and people there are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters. Then, if the fool is one who kills living beings, takes what is not given, misconducts himself in sensual pleasures, speaks falsehood, and indulges in wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence, he thinks, "These people are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters. These things are found in me," in other words, those five, breaking the five precepts, "and I am seen engaging in those things. This is the first kind of pain and grief that a fool feels here and now." So essentially here, a fool, somebody who does bad words, does bad in word, deeds, and thoughts, essentially here, is described as somebody who breaks the five precepts. So you can see how important the five precepts are here. Again, when a robber culprit is caught, a fool sees kings having many kinds of torture inflicted on him, having him flogged with whips, beaten with canes, beaten with clubs, having his hands cut off, his feet cut off, his hands and feet cut off, his ears cut off, his nose cut off, his ears and nose cut off, having him subjected to many kinds of torture with names like the porridge pot, the polished shell shave, the Rahu's mouth, the fiery wrath, the flaming hand, the blades of grass, the bark dress, the antelope, the meat hooks, the coins, the lie pickling, the pivoting pin, the rolled up palias, and having him splashed with boiling oil, and having him thrown to be devoured by dogs, and having him impaled alive on a stake, and having his head cut off with a sword. These are basically just a large number of different types of torture, basically, that were used at the time of the Buddha. And these are all described in quite literal, quite sort of graphic terms in the commentary to the sutta. Then the fool thinks thus, because of such evil actions as those, when a robber culprit is caught, kings have many kinds of torture inflicted on him. They have him flogged with whips, etc., etc., and have his head cut off with a sword. Those things are found in me, and I am seen engaged in those things. This is the second kind of pain and grief that a fool feels here and now. It's quite interesting here. It's actually, the point here is that he's actually just thinking, just the knowledge that breaking the five precepts actually inflicts, causes one to be punished in this way. Just as knowledge is actually enough here for him to feel all kind of dukkha and suffering. It's not actually the infliction of those tortures themselves which are the pain here. So it's just the fact that you know that you're going to be punished when you do something bad is enough to sort of spread the kind of negative state of your mind, which is in itself is suffering here. Again, when a fool is on his chair or on his bed or resting on the ground, then the evil actions that he did in the past, his bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct, cover him, overspread him, and envelop him. Just as the shadow of a great mountain peak in the evening covers, overspreads, and envelops the earth, so too, when a fool is on his chair, or on his bed, or resting on the ground, then the evil actions that he did in the past, his bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct, cover him, overspread him, and envelop him. Then the fool thinks, I have not done what is good. I have not done what is wholesome. I have not made myself a shelter from anguish. I have done what is evil. I have done what is cruel. I have done what is wicked. When I pass away, I shall go to the destination of those who have not done what is good, etc., but who have done what is wicked. He sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. This is the third kind of pain and grief that the fool feels here and now. And I find that similarly here with the being covered by the bad deeds that you do. I find that quite a powerful simile, because this basically is about karma and the law, how karma works for a person. And it's like when you do a lot of bad deeds, it's a bit like it covers all those bad deeds, covers over your mind, and they make your mind dark and even depressed. And obviously, the more bad deeds you do, the more these bad deeds will tend to cover over the mind and make the mind dark. And I really love that simile with just like a mountain, because a mountain is obviously some enormous thing, some kind of something solid, a mass of some solid mass, which basically stands over you and casts a shadow over you. In exactly the same way, a mass of bad deeds will tend to cover over your mind and cast a shadow over it, make it dark, and make it depressed. And there's nothing you can do about it. Just like you can't move the mountain, you won't be able to move away those bad deeds. And of course, that is why when one comes, the time comes to pass away and to get reborn, it is impossible that you should get reborn in a good state, because a dark mind will go to a dark place. A dark mind is not able to experience happiness. So how can you get reborn a Devaloka where there's only happiness? You can't. You will have to go to a dark state simply because of the darkness in the mind. Obviously, minds tend to be a little bit dark, a little bit bright, so exactly where you get reborn will depend on many, many factors. But generally, the more dark you are, the more difficult it is to get reborn in a good place. So it's a bit like a mountain covering over you, basically. And it doesn't really matter so much. He says here, the full things I have done, I have not done what is good, I have not done what is wholesome. But if your mind is very dark, you don't even have to think these things. It will still be, but it's like a depression. You don't have to think bad thought to be depressed. You will feel depressed even if you don't have any bad thoughts. So. Okay, so from there, the Buddha then says, a fool who has given himself over to misconduct of body, speech and mind on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination, even in hell. This is a summary of the three states of the ghost realm, the animal realm and the hell realm. This is what is meant by this last phrase here. Okay, and now comes a description of what it is like to get to what hell is like. So just to, I find this a bit interesting actually, just to have some idea what it's like. I think generally speaking, you have to do a lot of bad deeds to get reborn in hell. Chances are that you get reborn in an animal realm or ghost realm before that. But it's nice to know, so I have some idea what this is like. Okay, so the Buddha then goes on. Were it rightly speaking to be said of anything that is utterly unwished for, utterly undesired, utterly disagreeable, it is of hell that, rightly speaking, this should be said. So much so that it is hard to find a simile for the suffering in hell. When this was said, a bhikkhu asked the Blessed One, "But, Venerable Sir, can a simile be given?" "It can, monk," the Blessed One said. "Monks, suppose men caught a robber culprit and presented him to the king, saying, 'Sire, here is a robber culprit. Order what punishment you will for him.' Then the king said, 'Go and strike this man in the morning with 100 spears. And they struck him in the morning with 100 spears. Then at noon the king asked, 'How is that man?' 'Sire, he is still alive.' Then the king said, 'Go and strike that man at noon with 100 spears. And they struck him at noon with 100 spears. Then in the evening the king said, 'How is that man?' 'Sire, he is still alive.' Then the king said, 'Go and strike that man in the evening with 100 spears. And they struck him in the evening with 100 spears. What do you think, monks? Would that man experience pain and grief because of being struck with 300 spears? Venerable sir, that man would experience pain and grief because of being struck with even 1 spear, let alone 300. Then, taking a small stone the size of his hand, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, 'What do you think, monks? Which is the greater, this small stone that I have taken the size of my hand, or the Himalayas, the king of mountains?' Venerable sir, the small stone that the Blessed One has taken the size of his hand does not count beside the Himalayas, the king of mountains. It is not even a fraction. There is no comparison there. So too, monks, the pain and grief that the man would experience because of being struck with 300 spears does not count beside the suffering of hell. It is not even a fraction. There is no comparison here. Now the wardens of hell torture him with the fivefold transfixing here. They drive a red-hot iron stake through one hand. They drive a red-hot iron stake through the other hand. They drive a red-hot iron stake through one foot. They drive a red-hot iron stake through the other foot. They drive a red-hot iron stake through his belly. There he feels painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yet he does not die, as that evil action has not exhausted its results. Next, the wardens of hell throw him down and pair him with axes. There he feels painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yet he does not die so long as that evil action has not exhausted its result. Next, the wardens of hell set him with his feet up and his head down and pair him with adzes. There he feels painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yet he does not die as long as that evil action has not exhausted its result. Next, the wardens of hell harness him to a chariot and drive him back and forth across ground that is burning, blazing, and glowing here. There he feels painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yet he does not die so long as that evil action has not exhausted its result. Next, the wardens of hell make him climb up and down a great mound of coals that are burning, blazing, and glowing. There he feels painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yet he does not die so long as that evil action has not exhausted its result. Next, the wardens of hell take him feet up and head down and plunge him into a red-hot metal cauldron that is burning, blazing, and glowing. He is cooked there in a swirl of froth. And as he is being cooked there in a swirl of froth, he is swept now up, now down, and now across. There he feels painful, racking, and piercing feelings. Yet he does not die so long as that evil action has not exhausted its result. So you see here, the thing about hell is that you have a different kind of body that you have in the ordinary human realm, because this body is incapable of dying until you actually have finished all the bad effects of the bad karma you made. So it's a different sort of body you get in hell. Next, the wardens of hell throw him into the great hell. Now, as to that great hell, monks, it has four corners and is built with four doors, one set in each side, walled up with iron and all around, and shut in with an iron roof. Its floor as well is made of iron and heated till it glows with fire. The range is a full 100 leagues, which it covers all pervasively. Monks, I could tell you in many ways about hell, so much so that it is hard to finish describing the suffering in hell. And the next sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya actually describes the hell realms even in more details and more graphically here. But that's all he says about hell in this sutta. And now we go on to the animal realm and talking about the suffering in the animal realm. Monks, there are animals that feed on grass. They eat by cropping fresh or dry grass with their teeth. And what animals feed on grass? Horses, cattle, donkeys, goats and deer, and any other such animals. A fool who formerly delighted in tastes here and did evil actions here, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappears in the company of animals that feed on grass. I'm not sure why they have who formerly delighted in tastes, but maybe the idea here is that you delight in taste, and as a result of that, you because of your bad actions, all you get to eat is dry grass and green grass and nothing besides. The next animals here are actually feeding on dung. So there are animals that feed on dung. They smell dung from a distance and run to it, thinking, "We can eat, we can eat." Just as Brahmins run to the smell of a sacrifice, thinking, "We can eat here, we can eat here," so too these animals that feed on dung smell dung from a distance and run to it, thinking, "We can eat here, we can eat here." And what animals feed on dung? Fowls, pigs, dogs, and jackals, and any other such animals. A fool who formerly delighted in taste here and did evil actions here, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappears of the company of animals that feed on dung. So you can see here, if you delighted in taste previously, then if you do enough bad actions, you will actually get to eat dung in your next life. This story reminds me a little bit of Ajahn Brahm's story in the opening door of your heart. Do you know the story about the dung beetles in the opening door of your heart? You know the story? Yeah. The dung beetle clings to the pile of dung. And obviously he just cannot let go of that pile of dung anymore. And this is obviously a bit like what's happening here, basically. Okay, then the Buddha says, there are animals that are born, age, and die in darkness. And what animals are born, age, and die in darkness? Moths, maggots, and earthworms, and any other such animals. A fool who formerly delighted in tastes here and did evil actions here, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappears in the company of animals that are born, age, and die in darkness. There are animals that are born, age, and die in water. And what animals are born, age, and die in water? Fish, turtles, and crocodiles, and any other such animals. A fool who formerly delighted in tastes here, and did evil actions here, on the dissolution of the body, after death, reappears in the company of animals that are born, age, and die in water. There are animals that are born, age, and die in filth. And what animals are born, age, and die in filth? Those animals that are born, age, and die in a rotten fish, or in a rotten corpse, or in rotten porridge, or in a cesspit, or in a sewer. A fool who formerly delighted in tastes here, and did evil actions here, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappears in the company of animals that are born, age, and die in filth. Okay, the word here, when it talks about tastes here and evil actions here, here in the Pali is always a reference to this world as opposed to the world after death. So that is basically just means this world, and then after death you reappear somewhere unpleasant. Monks, I could tell you in many ways about the animal kingdom, so much so that it is hard to finish describing the suffering in the animal kingdom. Suppose a man threw into the sea a yoke with one hole in it, and the east wind carried it to the west, and the west wind carried it to the east, and the north wind carried it to the south, and the south wind carried it to the north. Suppose there were a blind turtle that came up once at the end of each century. What do you think, monks? Would that blind turtle put his neck into that yoke with one hole in it? He might, venerable sir, some time or other at the end of a long period. Monks, the blind turtle would sooner put his neck into that yoke with a single hole in it than a fool, once gone to perdition, would take to regain the human state, I say. Why is that? Because there is no practicing of the Dhamma there, no practicing of what is righteous, no doing of what is wholesome, no performance of merit. There, mutual devouring prevails, and the slaughter of the weak. So that is why, obviously, as a human being that you have to do good, as a human being that you have to practice the Dhamma, five precepts, generosity, and all these things. Because once you, if you happen to be reborn in these states, there's basically nothing you can do. You just have to wait for your bad karma to come to an end, basically. Yeah. I don't think this is really a reference to this world. It's basically just a reference to what the animal world is like. Yeah. So basically, this is just basically about the result of bad karma, really. Yeah. So this is what you will experience, or anyone will experience who breaks the five precepts habitually, for example. Yeah. So it doesn't really relate to this world so much, because this world, if you get reborn as a human being, even if you don't practice the five precepts, this world is only always going to have some amount of pleasure in it. Because as a human being, that's how this world works. You have created enough good cause in the past to actually be able to enjoy those pleasures, even if you do bad. So this world basically is what it is, but it's after death. Obviously, your mind obviously matters a lot as well. Obviously, you can be miserable in this world, but the physical pleasures that you get from being a human being will be pretty much the same. So this is really about after death, what happens after death. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. As I said before, I think maybe the reason is that you have all this craving for taste. You can imagine you're really enjoying yourself. I think it is probably generalized craving, yeah. But physical taste is obviously one of them, yeah.
So what would be the distinction between going to one place versus another? With regard to the distinction between craving and taste. So you said that you go to this place with dry grass, you might go and eat this place with chicken. How is the distinction in the sorts of craving?
Right. Well, I mean, these things are very individual because, you know, it depends on your karma, obviously. Yeah. If you've got very bad karma and you really and you hate dung more than you hate grass, you're more likely to be reborn among those who eat dung. Yeah. Right? Because your experience will be worse. The worse your karma is, the worse your experience will be. Yeah. So it depends on your craving and on your karma, those two factors. So if you have strong craving for something, then the opposite will happen, the opposite to that craving here. Yeah. And it will be more opposite the worse your karma is there. Does that make sense?
Sort of,
yeah.
But in terms of, I'm not really clear about the distinctions that the Buddha's trying to make here with regard to the different types of fair endings that he ends up with. Is it patience for behavior in the opposite direction in this life?
I'm not sure if the Buddha is actually trying to make a distinction here. I think that what he's doing is basically just showing how much suffering there is in the animal world. You might think that as an animal, you know, you're a dog in a nice house and the people, they feed you nice food, and you think that's the extent of the animal world, but it isn't. I think what he's doing here is just showing you the extent of the animal world and showing you the various possibilities in the animal world. I don't think he's necessarily linking it, each one of those destinations with a particular karma. I mean, there will tend to be a particular karma linked up with these things. But I don't think that's the point of this teaching here. Yeah. Otherwise, he probably would have said more about the actual action that you have to do to get those results. So I think the point here is just to say, well, the animal world can be pretty bad. You know, it may seem, you may think that to be a kangaroo jumping around the bush is very nice, but as a matter of fact, you're much more likely to be, you know, reborn as a dung beetle if you do really bad actions than a kangaroo. Yeah. So I think that's the main point here, is that the animal world is basically a place you don't want to be here. That's what he's trying to say here. Yeah. And the other thing is that if you do a lot of bad actions, is obviously that the whole point of the simile here with the yoke, which is thrown on the ocean, is that if you do a lot of bad action and you don't have any good karma in reserve, so to speak, it means that you don't have anything to help you get reborn in the place again afterwards. So we tend to stay there and stay there and stay there until, you know, all that bad karma is exhausted. And if you haven't done much good action, it will take a very long time before it's exhausted. But say if you have a person, for example, who has done lots of good action, but also done a few bad things, just like most of us, then it's possible that you might get reborn in a bad state. But usually because you have done all those good actions, those few actions you've done will exhaust themselves very quickly and very, very fast. The good actions will make sure that you get reborn in a good destination again. So it's, you know, this is cumulative, basically. It's very much, very much cumulative. So if your general habit is to be a good person, keeping the five precepts, basically, even if you should be so unlucky to get reborn temporarily in a bad destination, it will be very temporary. There is actually a sutta which talks about precisely that. It's about one of the queens of King Pasenadi of Kosala, and she lied about something. But she was essentially a very virtuous woman. Had very, you know, faith in the Buddha and kept the precepts and all that. But because of that lie, it was quite a serious matter. She got actually reborn in a bad destination. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it only lasted for 6 or 7 days. It didn't last for, you know, until this turtle puts his head through the yoke, which is basically incredibly long, obviously. And then she got reborn in the heavenly realm after that. She went straight from, you know, a very miserable place to the heavenly realm.
Is the impact also that it's not a short path to where we are on the continuous evolution, and you get gravitational and the impact, there is no guarantee that you will slowly evolve to more harmony in the world, that it is a matter of karma.
Yeah. There is no guarantee precisely. Yeah. There's no guarantee here. And that's why it is so, that's why samsara can be quite frightening, you know, because there is no guarantee. Obviously, the best thing you can do is to practice these things, and the more you practice it, the less chance are that, you know, you will go in the wrong direction. That's why you try to practice these things. But at the end of the day, no, there is no guarantee here. But the more you incline to the Dhamma, the more you incline in the right way here, obviously, the greater the chance is that you will continue to incline in the same way after you pass away. Because, after all, it's the mind and the tendencies of mind which pass on to the next life. So if you have the tendency in this life, you will also have the same tendency in the next life. So you just build up those tendencies as highly as you possibly can. Okay, so then... basically, the Buddha was saying here that in the animal realm there is mutual devouring which prevails, and the slaughter of the weak. And then he goes on, if some time or other, at the end of a long period, that fool comes back to the human state, it is into a low family that he is reborn, into a family of outcasts, of hunters, of bamboo workers, of cartwrights or scavengers. One that is poor, with little to eat and drink, surviving with difficulty, where he scarcely finds food and clothing, and he is ugly, unsightly, and misshapen, sickly, blind, cripple-handed, lame, or paralyzed. He gets no food, drink, clothes, vehicles, garlands, scents, or an unguents, bed, lodging, and light. He misconducts himself in body, speech, and mind. And having done that, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. So this is obviously what he's saying here is that somebody, if you are really foolish, what you do is that you start off in a bad destination, and after a long, long time, you get reborn in the human realm, and because of your propensity, your tendency of mind is actually to do bad things. As soon as you get reborn in the human realm again, you start doing bad things again. Because in the human realm, you can't remember where you were in your past life. So you don't know. It's just the propensities of the mind which carry on. So this propensity will carry on again. And for that reason, you continue doing bad things. And then you go back down to hell again. So it's quite a terrible, terrible thing, really. So if you don't have some kind of sense of what is good and what is right in the world, then you can just keep going like that for a very long period of time. Suppose, monks, a gambler at the very first unlucky throw loses his child and his wife and all his property, and furthermore goes into bondage himself. Yet an unlucky throw such as that is negligible. It is a far more unlucky throw when a fool who misconducts himself in body, speech, and mind on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. This is the complete perfection of the fool's grade. Basically, the complete perfection of foolishness is what he's saying here. Okay, so now we come to the happier side of things. This is the wise man, how the wise person behave. This is a little bit more uplifting here. So the Buddha says here, monks, there are these three characteristics of a wise person, signs of a wise person, attributes of a wise person. What three? Here, a wise person is one who thinks good thoughts, speaks good words, and does good deeds. If a wise person were not so, how would the wise know him thus? This person is a wise man. a true person, in other words, a superior person. But because a wise person is one who thinks good thoughts, speaks good words, and does good deeds, a wise person knows him thus. This person is a wise person, a superior or a good person. Note here that it's only the wise person who knows that this man is a wise man, a wise person. The foolish person obviously is not able to understand that. And it was exactly the same also if you look back on the previous, on the foolish person. It's exactly the same thing. It's only the wise man or the wise person who is able to recognize the foolish person. Okay. I should also maybe say that the true man here, Saparisa, I mentioned before that it usually refers to Aryas, those who have seen the Dhamma and have deep insight. But in this case, it actually seems to have a slightly wider meaning. It basically means anybody who is considered wise according to this this particular definition here of doing good acts. The Buddha then goes on. A wise man feels pleasure and joy here and now in three ways. If a wise person is seated in an assembly or along a street or in a square, and people there are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters, in other words, about morality, then if the wise person is one who abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, from wine, liquor and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence, he thinks, these people are discussing certain pertinent and relevant matters. Those things, the breaching of the five precepts, in other words, are not found in me. I am not seen engaging in them. This is the first kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels here and now. Again, when a robber culprit is caught, a wise man sees kings having many kinds of torture inflicted on him. The same tortures I just spoke about before. Then the wise man thinks thus. Because of such evil actions as those, when a robber culprit is caught, kings have many kinds of torture inflicted on him. Those things are not found in me. I am not seen engaging in those things. This is the second kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels here and now. So you can see here how the just that sense that you know that there is nothing that you should be punished for, and that you, when people talk about morality, you know that you are actually doing these things, you're actually following the precepts, is enough to give the mind a sense of freedom and liberation and freedom from fear, basically. Anybody who obviously breaks the law is going to have some kind of fear that, you know, somebody will catch them and put them in prison or something. So that in that's already is happiness and joy. Again, when a man is on his chair or on his bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that he did in the past, his good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, cover him, overspread him and envelop him. Just as the shadow of a great mountain peak in the evening covers, overspreads and envelops the earth, so too when a wise man or wise person is on their chair or on the bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that they did in the past, the good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, covers them, overspreads them and envelops them. Then the wise person thinks, I have not done what is evil. I have not done what is cruel. I have not done what is wicked. I have done what is good. I have done what is wholesome. I have made myself a shelter from anguish. When I pass away, I shall go to the destination of those who have not done what is evil, etc., who have made themselves a shelter from anguish. He does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. This is the third kind of pleasure and joy that the wise man feels here and now. So here again you have the exact opposite. If you do a lot of good, then those good acts will overshadow your mind, would tend to almost like take over your mind, and your mind will become bright and clear and happy as a result of that. So in the evening, when you find some peace, you come back from work or whatever, and you settle down, in a sense, you sit back. Yeah, your mind will tend to feel that happiness and joy, yeah, which comes from having done good actions. Sometimes in the hustle or bustle of things, you may not feel very much, but as soon as you settle down a bit, that will come back to you. That's basically the message here, as I understand it. Okay, so the Buddha then goes on. A wise man who has given himself over to good conduct of body, speech and mind on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in a happy destination, even in heaven. So then comes the description of the heavenly realm. It goes on for quite a while there. Were it rightly speaking to be said of anything that is utterly wished for, utterly desired, utterly agreeable, it is of heaven that, rightly speaking, this should be said, so much so that it is hard to finish describing the happiness of heaven. When this was said, a monk asked the Blessed One, but, Venerable Sir, can a simile be given? It can, monk, the Blessed One said. Monks, suppose that a wheel-turning monarch possess the seven treasures and the four kinds of success, and because of that experience pleasure and joy. Okay, I'll just pause there for a second just to explain what's going on here. A wheel-turning monarch is basically like a Buddhist legend. It's a legend of a king who is an absolute ruler, basically. And this wheel-turning monarch rules according to Dhamma, rules according to morality and virtue. And that's why this is considered, in a Buddhist context, it's considered the highest form of government, because you actually have a ruler who rules according to morality and rules according to, you know, to what is good, basically, according to Dhamma, if you like. So in Buddhism, this, in a sense, is considered even better than a democracy, because in democracy you get a bit of both. But obviously, if you have somebody, if you have a monarch who is really pure in his heart and really acts according to what is moral, that would probably be even better than a democratic society we have today. Obviously, with democracy, at least you can keep the bad kings out. But if you really, really have a good king or queen, for that matter, then they will be obviously even better. So this is basically what comes now is basically about this myth of the wheel-turning monarch. And they are always said to possess seven types of treasure, and here also four kinds of success. So this goes on to describe what these seven treasures are and the four kinds of success. Okay, so what are the seven treasures? Here, when a head-anointed noble king has bathed his head on the Uposatha day of the 15th, this is the ancient Indian way of counting the days of the month. The Uposatha day is the observance day when people would observe sometimes eight precepts, and they would go and listen to the Dhamma, go to the monastery. And he had ascended the upper palace chamber for the Uposatha. There appears to him the divine wheel treasure with its 1,000 spokes, its tire, and its nave, complete in every aspect. On seeing it, the head-anointed noble king thinks thus, now it has been heard by me that when a head-anointed noble king has bathed his head on the Uposatha day of the 15th and has ascended the upper palace chamber for the Uposatha, and there appears to him the divine wheel treasure with its 1,000 spokes, its tire, its nave, complete in every aspect, then that king becomes a wheel-turning monarch. Am I then a wheel-turning monarch? Then the head-anointed noble king rises from his seat and takes a water vessel in his left hand. He sprinkles the wheel treasure with his right hand, saying, turn forward, good wheel treasure. Triumph, good wheel treasure. Then the wheel treasure turns forward, rolling in the eastern direction. And the wheel-turning monarch follows it with his fourfold constituent army. The fourfold army is the army of horses, cavalry if you like, elephants, chariots and infantry. Now, in whatever region the wheel treasure pauses, there the wheel-turning monarch takes up his abode with his four constituent army. And opposing kings in the eastern direction come to the wheel-turning monarch and speak thus, "Come, great king, welcome, great king, command, great king, advise, great king." So this is what happens when you have a wheel-turning monarch. Instead of bringing out the arrows and the guns, they say welcome to him. The wheel-turning monarch speaks thus, "You should not kill living beings. You should not take what has not been given. You should not misconduct yourself in sensual pleasures. You should not speak falsehood. You should not drink intoxicant. You should eat what you are accustomed to eat." And the opposing kings in the eastern direction submit to the wheel-turning monarch. So that's why this monarch is so great, because he basically rules according to Dhamma. He rules according, he teaches people the precepts, basically. Then the wheel treasure plunges into the eastern ocean and emerges again. Then it turns forward, rolling in the southern direction. And the opposing kings in the southern direction submit to the wheel-turning monarch. Then the wheel treasure plunges into the southern ocean and emerges again. And then it turns forward, rolling in the western direction. And the opposing kings in the western direction submit to the wheel-turning monarch. Then the wheel treasure plunges into the western ocean, emerges again, and then it turns forward, rolling in the northern direction. And the opposing kings in the northern direction submit to the wheel-turning monarch. Basically, the whole thing is repeated for all of the directions with the precepts, etc. Now, when the wheel treasure has triumphed over the earth to the ocean's edge, it returns to the royal capital and remains as if fixed on its axle at the gate of the wheel-turning monarch's inner palace as an adornment to the gate of his inner palace. Such is the wheel treasure that appears to the wheel-turning monarch. There's one thing which is just a little point which is a bit interesting there, is that if you see what happened to that wheel treasure, you will see that it went down into the it went all the way to the eastern ocean, it went to the southern ocean, it went to the western ocean, and it plunged into the ocean, all those three accounts. But when it went to the north, it didn't plunge into the ocean. So this is basically, as I understand it, a sign that this is the world here. It's basically just another name for India in this case, because India obviously has ocean east, west, and south, but not to the north. So I think this is a reference to India. Okay. Then the next treasure. Again, the elephant treasure appears to the wheel-turning monarch, all white with sevenfold stance. With supernormal power flying through the air, the king of elephants, named Uposatha. On seeing him, the wheel-turning monarch's mind has confidence in him thus, "It would be wonderful to ride the elephant, if he would undergo taming." Then the elephant treasure undergoes taming, just like a fine thoroughbred elephant, well tamed for a long time. And it so happens that the wheel-turning monarch, when testing the elephant treasure, mounts him in the morning, and after traversing the whole earth to the edge of the ocean, he returns to the royal capital to take his morning meal. So it's obviously happening very fast, because he mounts him in the morning and comes back before breakfast. Thus is the elephant treasure that appears to a wheel-turning monarch. Again, the horse treasure appears to the wheel-turning monarch, all white, with a raven black head, with mane like mundra grass, with supernormal power flying through the air, the king of horses named Valahaka, Thundercloud. On seeing him, the wheel-turning monarch's mind has confidence in him thus, "It would be wonderful to ride the horse if he would undergo taming." Then the horse treasure undergoes taming, just like a fine thoroughbred horse well tamed for a long time. And it so happens that the wheel-turning monarch, when testing the horse treasure, mounts him in the morning and after traversing the whole earth to the edge of the ocean, he returns to the royal capital to take his morning meal. Such is the horse treasure that appears to the wheel-turning monarch. Again, the jewel treasure appears to the wheel-turning monarch. The jewel is fine beryl of purest water, 8-faceted and well-cut. Now, the radiance of the jewel treasure spreads around for a whole league. I think a league here is a Pali word is a the Pali word here is basically equivalent to basically 10 kilometers. So that's what it's meant here, approximately 10 kilometers. And so it happens that when the wheel-turning monarch is testing the jewel treasure, he draws up his 4 constituent army in array and mounts the jewel on top of his banner. He sets forth in the darkness and gloom of the night. Then all the inhabitants of the villages nearby begin their work by its light, thinking that it is day. Such is the jewel treasure that appears to a wheel-turning monarch. Again, the woman treasure appears to the wheel-turning monarch, beautiful, comely, and graceful, possessing the supreme beauty of complexion, neither too tall nor too short, neither too slim nor too stout, neither too dark nor too fair, surpassing human beauty without reaching divine beauty. The touch of the woman treasure is such that it is like a tuft of kapok or a tuft of cotton wool. When it is cool, her limbs are warm. When it is warm, her limbs are cool. From her body, the scent of sandalwood comes forth, and from her mouth, the scent of lotuses. She rises before the wheel-turning monarch and retires after him. She is eager to serve, agreeable in conduct and sweet in speech. Since she is never unfaithful to the wheel-turning monarch, even in thought, how could she be so in body? Such is the woman treasure that appears to a wheel-turning monarch. Again, the steward treasure appeals to the wheel-turning monarch. The divine eye, born of past action, is manifest in him, whereby he sees hidden treasures, hidden stores of treasure, both with owners and ownerless. He approaches the wheel-turning monarch and says, "Sire, you remain at ease. I shall take care of your monetary affairs." And it so happens that when the wheel-turning monarch is testing the steward treasure, he boards a boat and putting out into the river Ganges, in midstream, he tells the steward treasure, "I need gold and bullion, steward." "Then, sire, let the boat be steered towards one bank." "Steward, it is actually here that I need gold and bullion." Then the steward treasure plunges both hands into the water and draws up a pot full of gold and bullion, and he tells the wheel-turning monarch, "Is this enough, sire? Is enough done, enough offered?" "This is enough, steward, enough is done, enough offered." Such is the steward treasure that appeals to a wheel-turning monarch. Again, the counselor treasure appears to the wheel-turning monarch, wise, shrewd, and sagacious, capable of getting the wheel-turning monarch to promote that which is worthy of being promoted, and dismiss that which is that which should be dismissed, and to establish that which should be established. This is a reference, obviously, partly to the establishing, like the 5 precepts, for example, in the realm. He approaches the wheel-turning monarch and says, "Sire, you remain at ease. I shall govern." Such is the counselor treasure that appears to a wheel-turning monarch. These are the 7 treasures that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. Okay, so one might wonder to what extent is this to be taken literally and to what extent is this actually just mythology. But it's really not really the point to, I think, speculate, you know, whether this is to be taken literally or mythologically. Yeah. It's probably maybe it's part true, maybe part of it is mythology. Yeah. But the point is only to describe somebody who is in a state of obviously extreme comfort and extreme happiness, because basically has everything you could ever dream of having. Yeah. If you've got somebody who can just pull gold out of the water for you, it's pretty it's pretty good. You're gonna have a pretty easy life if you can do that sort of thing, yeah. So that's the main point here, is basically to show somebody who can has the highest type of human happiness possible. Yeah. That's the main point of this one. Yeah. I think some people have actually written on that particular topic, yeah, and I think some people have suggested that these might be the a simile for the seven factors of enlightenment, for example. Yeah. So that's one possibility. So yeah, this is like the worldly counterpart to the spiritual seven factors of enlightenment. So you have everything you can have in the world. If you have the seven factors of enlightenment, you have anything you can have spiritually. Yeah.
Well, take the last of your death. Clearly what it's saying here is you can know what to do, the right thing at the right time of truth.
Yeah.
That's the last one I said, that the counter, the one before that, you're not going to have money as well.
Right.
You'll be whatever you need will come to you. That's the most probably how I would have to mention it, that last one was said.
Right, yeah. Yeah, why not? Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, as I said, I think the point is that obviously the highest happiness of a person, that sort of thing, you don't have to worry about governing. You get anything you want at any time. You know, it makes good sense, doesn't it? It's sort of the highest possible human happiness, really. Yeah. So I think in that respect, it's the counterpoint to the highest possible spiritual attainment, which is the perfection of the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven bhujangas. Once you have perfected the seven bhujangas, that's the highest spiritual attainment you can have. So, yeah. Okay, so next you go on to the four kinds of success. What are the four kinds of success? Here, a wheel-turning monarch is handsome, comely, and graceful, possessing the supreme beauty of complexion, and he surpasses other human beings in that respect. This is the first kind of success, or maybe power is a good word, that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. Again, a wheel-turning monarch lives longer and endures longer, and he surpasses other human beings in that respect. This is the second kind of success that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. Again, a wheel-turning monarch is free from illness and affliction, possessing a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, and he surpasses other human beings in that respect. This is the third kind of success that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. Again, a wheel-turning monarch is dear and agreeable to Brahmins and householders, basically the people in his realm. Just as a father is dear and agreeable to his children, so too a wheel-turning monarch is dear and agreeable to Brahmins and householders. Brahmins and householders, too, are dear and agreeable to a wheel-turning monarch. Just as children are dear and agreeable to a father, so too Brahmins and householders are dear and agreeable to a wheel-turning monarch. Once a wheel-turning monarch was driven in a pleasure park with his four constituent army. Then Brahmins and householders went to him and spoke thus, "Sire, drive slowly, that we may see you longer." And so he told his charioteer, "Charioteer, drive slowly, that I may see the Brahmins and householders longer." This is the fourth kind of happiness of success that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. Okay. These are the four kinds of success that a wheel-turning monarch possesses. What do you think, monks? Would a wheel-turning monarch experience pleasure and joy because of possessing these seven treasures and these four kinds of success? Venerable sir, a wheel-turning monarch would experience pleasure and joy because of possessing even one treasure, let alone seven treasures and four kinds of success. Then, taking a small stone the size of his hand, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "What do you think, monks? Which is greater, this small stone that I have taken, the size of my hand, or the Himalayas, the king of mountains? Venerable sir, the small stone that the Blessed One has taken, the size of his hand, does not count beside the Himalayas, the king of mountains. It is not even a fraction. There is no comparison. So too, monks, the pleasure and joy that the wheel-turning monarch would experience because of possessing the seven treasures and the four kinds of success does not count beside the happiness of heaven. It is not even a fraction. There is no comparison. So that is, he finally comes back to the happiness of heaven again after having shown the highest possible human happiness and then comparing the heavenly happiness to the highest possible human happiness. For a heavenly realm. This literally means a heavenly realm. So this, obviously heavenly realms are many and varied. So you know, you have a vast variety of heavenly realms. So this would, you know, even in lower heavenly realms, there can be some suffering. Yeah. Just like a wheel-turning monarch obviously has some suffering. Yeah. But the higher you go, the more pure the happiness becomes. You have, like, for example, you have the realm of the contented devas. Well, a contented heavenly being means somebody who has no desires anymore. You know, you're basically contented with what you've got. And that is the, pretty much you're getting close to the highest happiness you can have without being enlightened in that state. And above that, you have the happiness of the jhanas, which are, you know, obviously very, very high. At some time or other, at the end of a long period, the wise man or wise person comes back to the human state. If he comes back to the human state, it is into a high family that he is reborn, into a family of well-to-do nobles, well-to-do Brahmins, or well-to-do householder, one that is rich, of great wealth, of great possessions, with abundant gold and silver, with abundant assets and means, and with abundant money and grain. He is handsome, comely, and graceful, possessing the supreme beauty of complexion. He obtains food and drink, clothes, vehicles, garlands, scents and unguents, bed, lodging and light. He conducts himself well in body, speech and mind. And having done so, on the dissolution of the body, after death, he reappears in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. So here you have the wise person. Again, you can see the exact opposite here of the foolish person. He starts off in the heavenly realm. Then when he gets reborn as a human being, he gets reborn in a very happy place among human beings. And then he does good because he has the propensity from a past life to do good. He continues to do good. And then he goes back to a heavenly world again afterwards. So you see there how the wise person would behave. Of course, it's perfectly possible to be reborn in a good family and do stupid things and then go down rather than go back to a heavenly world again. It's perfectly possible. So this only concerns the wise person. Huh? Monks, suppose a gambler at the very first lucky throw won a great fortune. Yet a lucky throw such as that is negligible. It is a far more lucky throw when a wise person who conducts himself well in body, speech and mind on the dissolution of the body after death reappears in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. This is the complete perfection of the wise man's grade, complete perfection of wisdom. Now, this last statement here has to be taken, is a relative statement. This doesn't mean the highest wisdom of enlightenment or anything like that. This just means the highest wisdom in a worldly sense, you know, before you get to enlightenment. This is what this is a reference to. So if you don't actually have those deep insights, which it takes to become at least a sotapanna, then this is basically the perfection of wisdom. Apart from that, that is what the Blessed One said, and the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. End of sutta. I would say it's definitely both of those. You know, you get a punishment in this very life right here from the remorse and the negativity and the darkness in your mind. If you do a lot of bad things, it becomes very dark because of that. That is a punishment and remorse you get in this very life. Right. So, but there are definite realms as well. You know, you are basically, for you, it feels like you're there. I mean, it is a type of rebirth. So just as you can be reborn as a human being, you can be reborn in these realms. And that is why it is one thing which makes samsara so frightening. And I like this because, I mean, it's very true. You know, what makes you do good, basically, what is more important is obviously to know that you gain some happiness out of doing good things. That's the more important incentive. I think it's more important to actually place emphasis on that. But I think this is obviously also an incentive to know that if you do bad, it's going to be painful for you. And it's going to be painful right here and now because you feel remorse and you feel darkness in your mind and all these things. But it's also going to be bad in the long term in the sense that you actually get reborn in a state, you know, where you feel all these things. So that's also an incentive. It's a negative incentive. And as I said, I think the positive incentive is far more important. But it's, you know, this is also there in the suttas. There's therefore a reason. If the Buddha taught it, we'll have to assume that it is correct and that it is an important, even an aspect of the path, which, you know, sometimes it's good to reflect on. Yes, sir. Well, simply because that, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that you became happy at being good, you probably wouldn't be good. If it wasn't for the fact that you made other people happy, you know, you wouldn't be good. There must be some reason why you do goodness. And the Buddha actually said that the highest incentive, the best reason for doing goodness is precisely because it makes you happy. That's what you... Yeah, you do feel it, but you have to remember that these are counterparts, right? If you do something bad, you know inside yourself you've done something bad. It doesn't feel nice, right? You know it feels bad inside, and it's precisely because it feels bad inside that it also will have a consequence in the future. These things are completely interlinked. These things go together, and if you do a lot of bad, so you feel really bad inside, then the mind becomes in such a state of darkness. That is completely impossible for that mind to experience happiness anymore. And that's why you cannot be reborn in a heavenly realm or even among humans. You actually have to go to a lower state because the mind is incapable of experiencing happiness. So you go to that lower state and then if you stay there for long enough, that darkness in the mind will disappear, you know, because you go through all these punishments, but all these negative experiences anyway, and over time that darkness will fade away, and some brightness will come back into the mind again. And when that brightness comes back into the mind again, that's what makes it possible to get reborn in the higher state again. So there's a direct link between how you feel in your mind and where you are going, you know, where you get reborn now. These are not separate issues. Well, you know, bad karma is really, karma is what you have done in the past life, right? And you experience the results of karma in this life. So if a child does bad things, it's strictly speaking, it's not bad karma, because it's, you know, if he gets reborn in a bad state, that's bad karma. But the fact that he does bad things, that's actually, in one sense, it is bad karma, because he's basically just probably acting on what they've done in the past life. So been bad in the past life, just continue acting, being bad now. But the fact that they're reborn in a happy family, for example, or a good family, that's good karma. But the main thing about how they act now is actually that your actions in this life are basically, that's where you can do something with your life. So a child which does bad things, there's potential for that child to change. It is not stuck in doing bad things, because that what you do in this life is not so much dependent on the past life. It's actually dependent on what happens to you in this life. That's why you can change. That's why you can do something good in this life. If all you did in this life was completely dependent on your karma in the past life, well, there wouldn't be any potential for change anymore, and you'd be stuck basically doing bad things. So. Yeah. Yeah, maybe you get a good car if you're reborn in it. Maybe it means you get a good car if you do a lot of good. Maybe it's a kind of the supreme vehicle, maybe. Yeah. So it's like a car, or it's like a you know, something like that.
Well, for me, an elephant is a vehicle for power.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think
what Ajahn Brahm means by power in that sense is actually good karma.
Yeah.
Because the power to be able to go to Paris, the money in the bank account, that's having enough karma to be able to do it. So if you want to go to heavenly realm, your bank account is a good karma, right? And the seed is the craving. Yeah. And we all have craving for happiness. That seed happens automatically. You don't really have to think much about it. If you have enough good karma, you will go to heavenly realm, because that's what we all want. Nobody wants to suffer. We all want to be as happy as possible, basically. Yeah. So, it could still be a metaphor for power, that you have a sense of power. But I think also, could very well be the case. But I think also it may just be a sense of vehicle, because one of the things that he mentions in there, as a result of good karma, is you get, you know, the vehicles that you want to. That's one of the things he talked about, the person who gets reborn in the good family. He gets good food, he gets vehicles, he gets all these things. And this may just be, the supreme vehicle. A vehicle which can fly through the air, take you anywhere you want in no time. Could be as simple as that. I don't know. I think actually there was a book in the library on the Seven Treasures of Wheel Turning Monarch. Yeah, some kind of commentary on it. You might be interested in reading. Yeah. I'm sure there's lots of literature about that sort of thing, particularly in the commentarial literature of the Pali, which talks about these sort of things in much more detail. Not in great detail, I think. Yeah, no, not really. Yeah, okay, yeah. It's a sort of it's quite mythological, I think. Yeah. So even though you're quite right that it probably has a symbolic significance, I'm sure it does. Of course it does. The Buddha doesn't say anything without a reason. But I think it's a sort of a slightly on the more mythological side of Buddhism. Yeah. Yes, John. I think that's the main point here. I think that's the particular. It may not be the. It may be that the seven treasures can be elaborated on, and in other suttas there are, you know, that you can speak about the seven treasures in different ways. But certainly in this sutta, that's the main point. But in other suttas, these treasures are used in different ways. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 No, you're quite right. You're quite right, actually. And the point is that these things are relative, right? There's a hierarchy here, if you like. It's shelter, more supreme shelter and the lesser shelter. And of course, the supreme shelter is to become a sotapanna. Huh? Once you become a sotapanna, you have entered the stream. You know that you're bound for enlightenment. You know that you cannot fall into these dark realms anymore. Huh? You have complete confidence because you have seen the Dhamma. You know what is going on, basically. You have seen this for yourself. The confidence is absolute. This is a relative confidence, which means that there might still be moments when you have doubt, but generally speaking, you will be confident. And generally speaking, you will not lament and have grief and anguish because of your bad conduct, at least. So there's a relativity there. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Eddie. Yeah. Well, the point of many of these things is that they are metaphorical, right? There's a metaphor for something here. And I think the metaphor there is that when you do bad acts, it's like you're lowering your mind. Your mind becomes a little bit more dark, a little bit more less happy. And that's a kind of a sense of, you know, the metaphor there, sinking, is a metaphor for darkness in the mind, for not having a bright mind, a happy mind. And the more bad deeds you do, the more that mind is going to resemble the mind of a ghost or an animal or even a being in hell. It's precisely because it resembles the mind of a being in those states, precisely because of that you actually get reborn in those states. It wouldn't be possible to get reborn as a ghost unless you already had a mind that was resembling that ghost. It would be impossible. If you have a happy mind, you cannot be reborn as a ghost. There's no way. It's because your mind is already there that when you pass away, you go into that state. So I think that Mahayana thing is just a symbol of that. And to that extent, it's the same thing, yeah. But, you know, it does, many of these things, like stress, is not, stress isn't a bad thing in its own right, you know. Because stress can pass away as soon as you have some time to relax and you know, just be by yourself. Stress can pass away again. The stress in its own right is not nothing which is going to lead to a bad destination or anything like that. And even depression doesn't necessarily lead to a bad destination. It's the, you know, the number of actions that you do which are really more important. You can be depressed and still be reborn as a human being. It's a different kind of darkness, which is much worse. The darkness which comes from bad actions it can be quite different from depression, I think. Yeah, I haven't really thought about that so much, but I think it's quite a different thing. Yeah. Okay, shall we? Anybody else? Shall we call it a day? Yeah. Let's pay our respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.